trying to get back to the basics of great products.
Power comes from sharing information.
I try to convince people to slow down.
Free. Yeah. Open.
This is the Soak Tyson Podcast.
Hello, dear listeners of the Slush, Soaked by Slush podcast. My name is Isak Rautio. Next to me is sitting William van der Balen. We are the guys from Futucast or Futurecast. We still haven't quite determined the pronunciation, the English-speaking pronunciation of our podcast name. But yeah, how are you doing? We're doing this Slush podcast marathon. How's it feeling so far?
It's been really great. This is actually the first episode where we try to figure out this logistical puzzle of switching mics in between. But this is great. This is the first double episode we've done all week, actually. I think it's the 15th podcast already this week we do. And this is going to be a really interesting one, I think. So our guests in this episode is Debora Revoltella and then Risto Stoikov from the European Investment Bank. Great to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Can we start off with a bit of an introduction? Who are you and what do you do and what does the European Investment Bank do?
Well, I guess ladies first, right?
Okay, then I start. I'm Debora Revoltella. I'm the chief economist of the European Investment Bank. And so I'm chief economist, so I study economic dynamics, and we try to understand how the market is developed, mostly European, but also extra-Europe, what is happening, and the environment in which the European Investment Bank operates. And the European Investment Bank is the European bank, if you want. The European member states are our shareholders, so we are a public bank. And we raise capital in the market to finance projects. And the projects that we finance are projects that have a special reason to be there, to be developed. So it can be something that is supporting innovation in Europe, can be something that supports climate change, something that supports growing up of small and medium enterprises. Or other purpose project, infrastructure is another area of our activities. So something that has a special purpose to be developed.
What kind of scale are you doing it? If it's a European scale, it seems it's probably quite on a large scale you do these operations.
Yeah, we are actually operating through all over the world. 90% of what we do is in Europe, but 10% is out of Europe, mostly in emerging markets. And we have a balance sheet, I think, at 500 billion. So we would lend 500, 600 or something. And we would lend on average 60 billion, depending of the year.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So not your everyday small neighborhood bank. It's quite a big organization then.
No, it's actually a hidden, in a way. It's something very hidden for probably your listeners, because the European Investment Bank is behind many of the driving forces in the European economy that you don't actually see in your daily life. We are one of the biggest venture capital investors through our venture capital arm, which is the European Investment Fund. So 60% of the VC funds in Europe are backed by money provided by the European Investment Bank Group. So we have 10 billion euros invested in VCs. We provide one third of this 60 to 70 billion euro per year lending to banks to actually give loans to SMEs to grow. And another one third we give to governments to support innovation. So we support a lot of university research. We support a lot of initiatives like the CERN in Switzerland. And we have a lot of investments in research infrastructure. And one third of the money we also provide to large corporates to scale up their research. So for example, we are supporting the next 5G development with Nokia, Ericsson. So we are trying to finance innovation through different angles and cover the whole value chain like that.
Yes, and hearing to all the listeners, it was Risto Stoikov. What do you do? What's your role inside the role?
True, like I didn't introduce myself. So my name is Risto Stoikov. I'm heading the front office operations of the bank, especially in an area called venture debt. So we are the largest venture debt provider in Europe. Over the last 4 years, we have pumped around 2 billion euros in more than 100 innovative companies across the whole continent, mostly in their late stage financing. So at the stage where they need to grow, where we have the biggest market gap in Europe. And that goes back to what Debora was saying, like what the bank does is it tries to fill market gaps. So basically inefficiencies in the market, innovation financing is a big thing for Europe in general, but in particular, if you start delving into the what we call the market gaps, you have what we call first valley of debt, of seed stage of companies. Many seed companies don't manage to raise financing and they just die. But then let's say you raise Series A, Series B, you already have raised like 30, 40, 50 million euros. You have a product that you have demonstrated it works. You need to scale it up. What do? You go to your VC funds. Yeah, but in Europe, we don't have the Sequoia capitals. Like, we don't have these multi-billion funds to help you grow. And you don't really want to dilute at that stage. So at that stage, we develop a product where we call long-term venture debt financing, where we provide tickets from 7.5 to 50 million euros, on average around 20 million euros, for companies to actually expand and grow without diluting themselves and extend their run rate. And that has been spectacularly successful over the last 4 years for us.
Yeah, so it's pure debt.
It is venture debt. Yeah. So technically, it's debt to companies that have no capacity to borrow at that stage. So they have no, most of the time, no assets. Most of the time, negative equity, negative EBITDA. But they have demonstrated that they have like some, let's say, tested product or some offtake agreements. So the due diligence process is similar to venture capital. And it's a very costly business for us because each euro we put in venture debt is treated like euro put in equity. So it eats up from our core capital ratio right away. So it is treated like as equity, but the legal form is debt and we are remunerated through stock options.
All right. This is a very interesting kind of way to do it. And something that clearly is needed. I have a few acquaintances and friends who have actually managed to get that financing from you in the past, and it's helped them out quite a lot. But since you are that big and you're that involved in the European, basically the whole Europe, you probably have a very, very wide view on the European economy and the market in itself. So maybe, Deborah, from your perspective, how is Europe looking and the European market looking at the moment?
I think the way we see the European economy is very much always looking at the long-term challenge. So today we are discussing about a deceleration of growth in Europe. So everybody is worried. We see that the manufacturing trade has been declining. The manufacturing industry is turning. We see that the automotive industry is really turning in terms of dynamics. But what we are worried is not only the cyclical component, the fact that we may be close to the end of a cycle. What we are really worried and what we are studying very much is the structural dimension of it. So if we go back to the automotive industry, what we see is that there is a structural transformation on the industry, and that is very much the consequence of various elements. On the one side, we know that the sector, we have some of the global leaders in terms of innovation, but they have been kind of stuck with certain technologies that are running out. They have not been too fast in innovating in the new areas of technology. And the market is changing in terms of preference of individuals. We see now the shift diesel versus other form, but soon will be on ownership of the car. Will the younger generation want to own the car? Will it be so important or not? So we have a number of structural change, and the European innovation system that is so much tied to automotive has been a little bit lagging behind in the capacity to renovate itself. And that's why it's so important to support instead these new startup and scaling up that are a source of innovation. We see, we just are publishing actually next week a study on startup and scaling up in Europe. What we see is that the startup and scaling up are behind most of are very much investment intensive. Obviously, they are smaller, they have to grow, they are investing intensive, but they are very much innovating. Most of them are trying to build something that at least they consider to be new to the world. So they are really going for something new. But then, as Krista was saying, in the development phase of these firms, you see at a certain point, at the very beginning, you have there is the first valley of debt, as you say, but at a certain point, you have a kind of funding. The venture capital market is starting to be developed. So I think 50% of firms in Europe that are they say they had also public money in the early phase of the venture capital, which means that there is support going. But then at a certain point, you start having the moment in which the firm is scaling up. And if you compare European firms to US firms, you see that the scaling up phase is much longer. Firms don't grow, and also the fund on the other side, they are much smaller. So really, in terms of size, you would see in the scaling up phase this trend in which in the US you have a pickup, both on the firm side in terms of size and on the fund side. Well, this doesn't happen in Europe. They stay stuck in between for a very long time. Period of time.
Why do you think this is? Where does this difference come from?
So in our study, what we were trying to do, we were looking at, we were interviewing 2,000 startup and scale up in Europe and the US, and we had a lot of data on those. But what we were trying to start with was, are these guys different in Europe and in the US? And the first thing is, no, they are not so different. Actually, both in Europe and the US, they wanted to start the company and grow the company. And, so they are ambitious. The one that start are ambitious. Somehow, in Europe, they really wanted to stay in the company. So I think there is a much higher share of people that start the company that wanted to remain and continue to manage the company. That may be a little bit... it's a positive on the one side, but maybe a negative if they are reluctant in leaving management, in evolving the company, etc. Over time, at a certain phase of scale up, you should also allow the company to become much more professional. So this may be an issue. But this is not the main difference that we saw. The key difference that we saw, Europe-US, is on the one side, kind of a more fragmented market in Europe. Europe, particularly in the service sector, yes, we have integrated service market, but in reality there are a lot of friction in the market. So if you ask to the entrepreneurs what is the market they are looking at, what is their target market, most of them say it's my local market, meaning the local or country level, not the European one. Well, in the US, it's the European one. So here there is kind of the target, a smaller market, and it's more difficult to move them from one market to the other. It's still a more fragmented Europe rather than US. But then what is the main impediment that we see is, we call it the lack of past success stories. So the fact that Europe doesn't have this many of these cases of companies that made it through all the process, and then once they have done it, they are kind of a pulling factor for the newcomers. Pulling factor that can come because they are... a market for the newcomers, because they buy products, they internalize it, etc., but also because they may buy the company in some cases, or they just represent an example. The lack of this pulling factor from the past success for us is the main issue that is preventing European scale up. But I was saying before, I'm the speaker, I'm the researcher, and we have now the investor, the guy that does it. So maybe we didn't confront each other too much before. But
Does this translate into what you're seeing as well as an investor?
Does. It's actually very relevant for us. And I'm really happy that Deborah and her team are doing this on a pan-European scale, because in the past, what we would do is we would just encounter these things in daily life, and they will always be taken in isolation. But when you have this pan-European study and you can see that is actually a prevailing trend, and then you see it daily in your deals, you realize that there is something structurally that is inconsistent. And when we talk about Europe, I always try to differentiate between the different regions of Europe, because we see that the VC money that we pump in Europe actually goes mostly to UK, France, Germany, and the Nordic countries. Why? Because you have all these elements that Deborah was mentioning already working on regional scales. You have basically cities like Paris or Berlin or London pulling a lot of entrepreneurs, like serial entrepreneurs that have exits. You have the VC money that matched with scientists. And that is where the money flows naturally. You have big market gaps further south you go. So Spain, already the fourth largest VC market, only represents 4% of the VC industry in Europe. And the whole of Eastern Europe, all the new member states probably represent less than 2% of the VC money in Europe. So there is a big structural gaps in Europe. And the segmentation is one big thing. Even if you find a successful company, and I'll give an example of a company we finance, it's called Quant. It is a French search engine, where basically the commission a few years ago, when they were starting the whole process with Google and like suing each other and everything, they said, why don't we have an independent index provider from Europe? Because whatever search engine you have, usually they use either the Bing index or the Google index, it being a DuckDuckGo and whatever, behind it is the Google index. So they were asking us, okay, what can we do about that? We found this startup team in France that have developed an algorithm how to basically provide search results which are untampered, and they're much actually faster than Google in terms of like, you know, spitting out the results. Axel Springer, the German media company, decided to back the company early stage with a couple of million euros, and then we put 20 million euros into them. And they said, look, if we want to develop a pan-European product and scale it up, we need to basically search every website that is in Spanish. But that means we have to search all the Latin American websites. Same for Portugal. We want to launch in Germany. We have to search any German website. That means Austria. That means Switzerland. So in order to scale up in Europe, they had to do like 10 times more investment than Google will do in the States, which is a unanimous, like, you know, one language, one market, one country of a continent size. And that was a clear example how good innovation on site. We tested it. It works. You can open it, quant.com. You can check, and it works. The problem is that if you check it in Czech Republic, for example, in Czech language, it doesn't probably give you the best results. Why? Because they still need to address each market separately, regulatory-wise, like also like to put people behind and everything. So it's much harder for them to scale up, even though they come from the center of Paris, where you arguably you have the startup ecosystem, you have the financiers and everything. So it's a prevailing problem, and that was just one example.
This fragmentation is interesting. Like this sort of the same dynamics are at play if you look at the Eurozone and the dynamics between that and the balances in the Target 2 and stuff like this. But what's the trend like in these? Like are the percentages going up and down? Is the discrepancy widening, or what kind of trends are you seeing in this field?
On the business side, and I'll let Deborah then explain.
Absolutely,
on the economic side, what we see in the last few years is a very positive development in Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe. So this big gap that I mentioned, it's being now closing, but it's a very big gap, so it will take time. But you fly to Warsaw, a city which I visit like regularly now every 1 or 2 years just to see some companies. Skyscrapers are mushrooming. Young people are being like, you know, hired by companies. They're coming back. The brain drain is being reversed. You look at companies like Bulgaria, where the European Investment Fund, our subsidiary, started 4 or 5 fund managers 5 years ago with 10 million euro size funds. Now they're raising their second and third fund. We have serial entrepreneurs starting up something similar to the Y Accelerator in Boston, where they teach each other, like they provide seed financing, and that is being perpetuated. So time will heal a bit of this gap, and also the reverse of this brain drain and having, like, you know, quality people in order for you to scale is important. When people go once or twice through the process, they learn and they know how to pitch for business and everything. But still, we are 5 times smaller in terms of VC market size than the US, although the number of SMEs and startups is equal and the size of the economy is equal. So funding will remain a prevalent market gap, even though regulation also needs to follow.
Yeah.
And I think if we switch completely on the macro side and in the financial sector side, we think we have seen a lot of, I would say before the crisis, you could talk about an integrated European financial market. The crisis showed that the integration was somehow also artificially driven. There were a lot of flows of funds among countries in the financial sector. There was a clear retrench, and now we are gradually coming back to normality, but it's still gradual, and we have some indicator of financial sector integration. You still see a lot of what we call home bias of investors. So in the banking sector, in the pension funds, etc., there is a lot of I know home, I invest at home. And then a home can be the Nordic countries, it can be the It's a very, very much a lack of trust, and there has to be much more push in this direction.
Do you think it's also partly just a perception issue that we are not aware of, for instance, Eastern Europe developing this fast? We see this problem, for instance, with investing in Asia or Africa, where we still think that all of Africa is very poor, there are no skyscrapers, nothing has happened. And people live in huts. Like, this is because this is what we've been taught when we went to school, and it's changing so fast. So could it also in part just be that we are unaware of how fast these markets and countries are changing?
Well, yes and no. To be honest, there was a natural resistance for venture capital firms from Western Europe and the States to go into Eastern Europe in the beginning, and the reason was simply that the know-how was not there. You would see very unhealthy cap tables. Like, you'll see seed or angel investors taking 20, 30, 40% of the stock of the company at a very early stage. With such a cap table at the beginning, you're doomed to fail, like basically to raise like proper financing at a later stage. You still have entrepreneurs who tell me, oh, look, I mean, why would I raise venture debt? Equity is for free. Well, how can you tell me that equity is for free? And that is a very notable entrepreneur, actually, at one of those unicorns from the region that told me that. It's not nobody. I mean, you cannot think that equity is for free. Like, so the know-how like has been building up. And I think now Western companies, Western VCs and Americans are starting to open up to the region because they see like people coming back there, like, you know, bringing know-how and like basically starting their own companies. And it helps. It helps because then the trust is being built. And I think like now I see some VC companies from France and the Nordics establishing like permanent presence there by hiring like one local person, good enough. I mean, like it's a good start. I think still VC funds in the Central East Europe should make probably much stronger links with venture capital firms in West and the States, because they're constrained by their size, and partnering up with Western firms will help them also transfer know-how on their side and like, you know, to scale up. There is a flip side to it. If you want to have a unicorn from the region, you have to either reallocate to UK or to the US. And that's what happened with UiPath, for example, one of the Romanian success stories that is now a multi-billion euro company. Yeah, but they had to move their headquarters to the States. A lot of fintechs develop all their business in Eastern Europe, but they're headquartered in UK. And it's part of the reason. Like, so, yeah, bringing Western know-how, it means that probably the people will also try to, you know, move part of the business to regulation or like areas where they feel more comfortable with. But it's happening. It's big.
What are you looking for? I think this is more of a question for you, but you have your unique insight into this, I'm sure, when it comes to like the economy and on a macro scale and how it's changing. And some people like Warren Buffett are talking about how even the standard of capitalism has been changing recently with stuff like climate change and social issues coupled with it. And what do you mentioned you were funding CERN in a big way, which is obviously a very scientific sort of scientific enterprise, not a classic business in any sense. So what are you looking for, and how do you see the economy changing and the sort of attitudes coupled with it?
I think in general, if I can start, we just had quite an important decision on the EIB point of view. So the European Investment Bank, we are the climate bank. So we have recently in our last board, we have approved a new energy lending policy that is kind of changing the composition mix of what we can finance. And we promise that we are already actually compliant to the Paris Agreement, the kind of financing that we do. And we have a very strong target in terms of getting to 50% of what we lend to be really going in climate compliant, if you can call it. So only on the greener part. But as an institution, we are evolving. We were already doing a lot, but we are really evolving in doing more. But I think the big change has to come from a different attitude of the public sector. And what is very good is that our shareholders are the European shareholders, are the European member states. They have been discussing a lot on what we as their own bank should do, but they found found an agreement and compromise, and they are going in this direction. And the European Commission is also working on the new Green Deal, and I think this is a very important opportunity for Europe overall to set the stage of European leadership in terms of moving fast in addressing the issue of climate change. And I see it happening. I'm crossing fingers because you never know, but I see it happening in terms of getting this policy agreement among the member states in going in a direction. And it's extremely important because it's true that in this moment we see the public opinion that starts to be very much going in the direction. But it's not enough only the public opinion. You really have an overall planning of a system of a transformation, given the right price incentive, given the right setting for the private sector to move in. And it has to come from the public sector. So I think it's very important to have the policy alignment and then the private sector involvement.
Absolutely. I think on the macro scale, what we are driven by is, big policy objectives. So, for example, for the next 7 years, we'll be looking at artificial intelligence, software security, we'll be looking at energy independence and basically new investments in new energy technologies and demonstration of different ways to generate energy and be self-sustainable. We'll be looking at inclusion. So we'll be looking to finance more gender-balanced type of companies. So we'll be looking also at different technologies to invest in, like what they call like steel economy 4.0. So robotics, machine vision. So all these like policy goals are then translated on ground to my team, which is now close to 30 people, and we run around Europe to conferences like that and try to find promising cases. And what we really focus is where you see the market gap, and the market gap could be in relation to the geographical positioning of the company, so therefore there is not much money in that region. But it could be also because of the information asymmetry between investors. A half of our portfolio is in biotech and life science. Very difficult segment. Unless you are coming from the background of this industry, it's almost impossible to understand what these companies are talking about. There is a huge benefit for the society. And we have developed programs, special programs that now deal with microbial resistance, with infectious diseases, because we believe that this is a big threat to society coming in the future. And pharma companies currently don't want to invest much money into a lot of these things, especially in what we call orphan diseases. So there are certain types of diseases that affect only a few thousand people in a population. It's not a blockbuster drug, but it requires still hundreds of millions of investments. So we are looking at market gaps, being lack of funding or being like lack of information or the lack of qualified investors. Why? Because as a European investment bank, we have this unusual for banking model where we have in-house engineers. So I'm not claiming that I know biotech, but what I can tell you is that when a biotech company approaches us, we have a full team of biotech and life science experts whose job is not to be bankers. They come from industry. We have ex-surgeons, we have like people that work for pharma companies, and they help us evaluate the different aspects of a certain investment. And therefore, we can be much more versatile and flexible to address certain needs in research.
I'm getting more excited about this bank by the minute. I think it sounds really, really important. And the fact that you have such scale also to actually deliver and put your money where your mouth is and not just, do one company here and there is really exciting. Maybe as a last question, what are you most excited about looking into the future?
I'm going to take that one.
I don't know. I'm thinking for Europe. For Europe, I think the opportunity of this really speeding up the innovation, the capacity of transform and innovate. And I think when you come in places like this, you see all the people going around and seeing all the opportunities that are there. You really see that we have such a human capital in Europe and that we really need to exploit it and support all this innovation capacity that is embedded in the European people. And I think this is something really, really something that we should leverage on.
To me, as always, I believe that Europe is still a fragmented market, but our strength is in our diversity. The fact that you can get really United States of Europe and like everybody bringing different experience and different view to the table makes us stronger. And I'm really excited about like, you know, moving this project forward and integrating the continent so that we can become viable player on the international scale and internally for us as a society. So that is really something that I'm excited about.
Yeah, I'm speaking for myself, and I'm sure I'm speaking for William here, like as a young European, and this project of European integration and unity in a way is very important for us. So I mean, kind of admire the work you're doing. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
It sounds very exciting, and thank you for joining, and we'll let you go invest and make a big impact on the world. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed your visit to that conversation as much as we did. Now, if you want to stay updated and keep in touch with us, please subscribe to us on YouTube, follow us on Spotify, subscribe to us on Apple Podcast and all other podcast platforms. We're also on Twitter, Instagram, and then Facebook. You guessed it, Soaked by Slush. Thank you, people, for listening. Bye-bye.